nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pig. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy, and that's true love and homegrown tomatoes.
All right, it's time for In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Bajarski and me here in the studio. This is Oren. And we want to thank the Flower Farm for helping support this program and the Garden Center, located behind Love and Matter, opening on April 24th with fuchsia baskets from Skagit and locally grown pansy bags and bedding plants from the Flower Farm. With bouquet subscriptions available, the Garden Center, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and the Flower Farm out there at Papke's Landing, open daily except Wednesday, 10 to 5. And we've got Ed Bajarski on the line. How are you, Ed?
Well, I'm pretty good, Oren, except for the cold and wet here in Juneau that I just came home to last night.
Oh, yes. That is happening. We've got real springtime weather going on.
Yeah, I heard I missed a week of sunshine here, and so this morning I checked my greenhouse and thermometers and such.
Yeah,
I've got a bunch of perennials slowly sprouting in pots, and the range of temperature for the week we were gone was from 25, the coldest, to 95 inside the greenhouse, which is a little extreme.
Good heavens! Yeah, that's got to be kind of hard for the plants to get excited about.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. Well, the perennials that we planted, we potted them up before we left, and my wife and I did, and so they're tough enough, and again, they were moist, so the moisture in there helped to moderate the temperature, so that was just the air temperature, that variation, but I would rather have the warmer than the colder, quite frankly. So everything we can do to warm things up, greenhouses and soil and all of that, I hope that folks have their garden beds covered with plastic to drain off all that moisture. Because, again, this cold rain, I mean, it's 40, I think it was 43 degrees when we drove into town today, and that cold rain, of course, cools the soil.
Right.
So if we can get it, keep that off, drain it off, and keep it a little warmer, even though, you know, there isn't any sun here, but still there is light which does penetrate the clear plastic to warm the soil underneath. Again, I know we've talked about that in the past, but again, it warms the soil much more than if it was covered with black plastic.
Right, right. So this time of year, clear plastic is the way you want to go.
You may in the summertime be interested in using or growing plants through black plastic or the IRT, which we've talked about too. That is the infrared transmitting. It's a greenish, slightly translucent. If you hold it up to the, you know, hold it up to, you can kind of see through it, but it only allows the infrared light to go through, and again, that warms the soil. But again, supposedly then it stops the type of light which stimulates plant growth, so it stops prevents weeds from germinating. So again, use the right kind of material. You may have to order that stuff online. I don't know if it's available for you in Petersburg. I don't believe the IRT, I haven't seen it for sale in Juneau either. So again, order it from Territorial Seeds or other, I imagine, the other big box that we won't mention their name, but you can probably order it through them too.
So IRT, that's infrared transmitting, for
yes,
warming the soil without stimulating weed growth.
Yes, exactly.
Nice. That's a good tip.
So I'm getting ready. I mean, I've taken the last piece of plastic, several pieces of plastic off my last garlic bed. The garlic's looking pretty good at this point. They would like it warmer too, but it's sprouting nicely. There's some that's 2 to 4 inches tall. That's a good thing. And I've also removed the boughs and other coverings that I had that were over the perennial beds. so again, and lots of primroses and blue poppies and other assorted stuff that are starting to sprout quite nicely, even with this weather. They are tolerant of it. I mean, they've survived here for a very long time. And those places where my boxes are covered with the clear plastic are hopefully warming, slowly warming the soil for potatoes and everything else that we're going to be planting. And so that's, let's talk about, I don't know if your, if some of your local retailers have certified seed potatoes yet. Ours have just showed up this past week here in Juneau. So folks could go and buy the type of potatoes, get them, you know, beat the rush, as it were. And of course, now there's going to be a rush, I suppose. But go down and choose, I mean, now, the potatoes you want. If you're so lucky to have choices that you can pick small ones, you know, like 1 inch or up to hen's egg size, pick more of those rather than the great big ones that you then have to cut into pieces. Take them home and put them in a warm spot. Those can be in a, and they can be in a, say, a paper bag that's in 60 to 70 degree temperatures, you know, in the house or something like that. And that will help stimulate them to sprout because they've been stored in cold root cellars, potato cellars, that sort of thing, through the winter. So once they start to warm up, then that's one of the signals for the potatoes to wake up and they start changing the sugars when they're really cold into starch, and then that is then becomes available to stimulate the growth of the plant.
Uh-huh. Nice. Okay, that's a good tip. So when people are picking out their seed potatoes, and what are, what do we want to be specifically looking for when we're shopping for seed potatoes?
Okay, so depending on your past history of what you're comfortable planting, like I mentioned, choosing, I like to choose, if possible, choose smaller ones. Those I can plant whole, say something up to a ping pong ball size or something. Once you get a little bigger than that, hen's egg size or larger, then usually you would want to cut those so you have at least one or two eyes on each piece.
Right.
But again, the smaller ones with no cuts mean that you have those cut surfaces. We don't normally worry about cutting them, you know, several days ahead of time before planting. But again, those cut surfaces potentially might be more easily infected by, say, some soil bacteria or fungus. So if we have whole potatoes, you don't have breaks in the skin, plant those, then there should be a little bit of less issue with that. Make sure they are nice, clean looking, and again, they're, we were just down south and I saw many garden centers that had them, and I saw where people had already been pulling out potatoes that look like they have these, well, rotten spots on them. I mean, you don't want to, don't choose those. Those need to go into the garbage. You know, reject those. And sometimes you'll see where potatoes, if they've been roughly handled a lot, you'll see, and whether that's from banging them together in transport or even in the digging process, you can see where there's cuts, kind of curved cuts in them, which usually heal up pretty well. But again, just watch for, watch that you don't get any obviously diseased or partially rotten potatoes. And that goes as well if you're, if you have, or if the gardeners have saved potatoes from last year, which I certainly do. And I did hand select some of those smaller ones to save for seed planting this year. Again, this is a good time of year to pull them out. In my case, they're in my root cellars, so I want to take them out and get them started sprouting for probably planting in another week or two, I'm hoping, when things start to warm up. But again, I'm going to be inspecting for the same thing to make sure that I've got nice, clean, healthy-looking potatoes. They don't have obvious scab pustules on them, so we're just reinfecting our soil with those.
Right. So when we're looking for like diseased seed potatoes, what are the things that we're looking to avoid?
Okay. So potato scab is probably our number one problem we have here in Southeast Alaska, and you will see these rough. They look kind of like irregular, 1 to 2 to 3 millimeter across. They look like little pustules, like pimples that have broken open. I mean, it's a crude way to look at it. Again, go online and do a Google or Bing search on potato scab, and there's some great pictures of that sort of thing. There's a couple of others that are possible, but not likely up here, so I'm not even going to really mention that. Some of them, though, there is a black. It looks almost like a very thin black growth, I guess, on the skin, which very often with your thumbnail you can scrape off. Usually isn't a problem. I'm sorry that I can't remember the exact name of that one. But normally it's not a problem. And there's a couple of other things, too, that we occasionally see. But the potato scab is our worst problem. Again, removing anything. If it appears that you have a variety that has a lot of rot in them, it is a slight possibility it might have actually had blight. I mean, the blight, the stuff that caused or resulted in the Irish potato famine. Mm-hmm. That might be, if you see a bunch of those, then, rotten potatoes in a bin. And truly, one rotten potato, like one rotten apple, can spoil the bin, the barrel, whatever.
Right.
Maybe you're better off getting rid of all of those. Or if there's some that are not, don't appear to be infected, maybe take them indoors, wash them, and eat, cook them and eat them. They're safe as far as that goes.
Gotcha.
But again, if you slice into some of these potatoes and you see that they have obvious brown, kind of brown watery inside rather than nice white, well, I suppose, unless, of course, they're purple or yellow potatoes. But anyway, you'll see that it looks kind of like brown and watery inside. Or from the skin, you might see them going through the skin partially into the potato flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Again, that's stuff to reject. And if you see that while you're cutting potatoes, then you should also sterilize your knife, whatever you're using to cut your potatoes. So, again, you aren't transferring these diseases into next pieces of potatoes that then might be planted.
Right. Okay. Those are good tips that pretty much scab and some of these other funguses or diseases are contagious within the potatoes. And so we want to,
Yeah, and
be
we can save, selective. I would say, probably wait another week or two, and we'll talk a little more about the actual planting of seed of potatoes. It is, I would say, though you can get away with planting them this time of year with the soil being so cold, there is that potential for rotting in the soil, and they just don't grow.
Right.
So they want warmer soil, just like everything else does. So let's just kind of save that for a little bit, some time ahead.
Yeah.
And again,
so for this
some of the other stuff we've talked about planting, spinach and peas and other stuff, if your soil is warm enough. And warm enough, if you've got a soil thermometer, that's a good way to check. If the soil is getting up to, say, 50 degrees or more, you push your soil thermometer in, and we're looking for pretty much just the top 2 to 4 inches. We go down much deeper, and certainly you can check that. Your deeper soil is going to be colder. Definitely, because that you get the heat from the sun on top. Mm-hmm. And at least this morning, again, I wanted to check, because when I left, I could poke into the soil around my garlic that I had uncovered only about 2 inches, and it was frozen. Mm-hmm. And now I can push in there 6 to 8 inches, and it is not frozen. So that's a good thing. So again, we are able to do some working of the soil. And if we have to mix some stuff in, and the other thing, of course, with the rain we're having, especially if you've got uncovered soil, if you're seeing puddling and stuff, water just staying on the surface, that might be another indication to loosen up your soil and mix in some more sand for better drainage.
Yes. Right. Drainage in the soil, that is a nice thing to amend this time of year, especially when it seems so soggy.
And the drainage helps. Draining the water off also allow better oxygen to get into the soil, and the roots of whatever we're going to be planting need oxygen. Most of the beneficial fungi and bacteria that are breaking down organic matter, compost, that sort of thing, need oxygen. Mm. So again, if you're going to be mixing that stuff in there, the more oxygen you have in that soil, the better.
Right.
Same thing if you're trying to do compost. Again, you want aerobic compost, more oxygen there to help break down the nutrients into a form that the plants then can use.
Yes. Those are good tips for soil preparation. And is that what you think is the best thing for people to be doing kind of in this rainy week, is still just kind of getting things ready for planting once the temperature is sort of warm enough?
Oh, it is. I mean, I suspect there's probably some of the folks in your neighborhoods, as well as mine, who have been out there digging and planting already. One of the things I'm going to be doing here almost as soon as I get home is starting to dig perennials. I've got plant sales, among other things, coming up. But that's something, too, that for those plants that you may want to divide, this is a fine time of year to do that while the plants are still just barely starting to sprout.
Yeah.
So doing some early division, or if you're going to be doing rhubarb. You know, again, the rhubarb is starting to sprout. You know, there's some of those nice big fat pink buds are starting to sprout there.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, if you want to divide some rhubarb, or particularly if the rhubarb clumps that you had last year had lots of small stems rather than fewer but larger stems, it may be time to dig up about, go sharpen up your shovel first, and dig down through into that big clump of your rhubarb you may have, and remove half of it. Hmm. Leave half in the soil with roots still attached and all. Mm-hmm. Take the other half out, maybe to give away, maybe to expand your rhubarb patch. And that chunk you take out may be able to be split into two or three or four pieces. And then, again, throw some more compost, steer manure, chicken manure, something like that, into that hole next to the rhubarb. Or if you're cleaning out your freezer and have some freezer-burned fish, bury that fish. And you can just take it out of the plastic container or bags that you have. Bury it frozen. So, and part of the advantage of that is so that your local critters, dogs and cats and whatever else, don't smell it so much.
Hmm.
But then as that fish rots in the soil next to the rhubarb, then it will grow better. The other thing about not disturbing part of that rhubarb is that the undisturbed portion you can harvest from this year.
Right.
Where those chunks that you dug out and may divide and replant, those you would normally want to allow to grow and not harvest this year, wait till next year till they get their new roots reestablished.
Gotcha. So the rhubarb is hardy enough that you don't have to worry too much about the sort of temperature, so to speak, of the compost and the fertilizer that you're amending. You can just kind of put her right nearby.
Yes, okay. Well, that's good. Yeah, the heat, the high nutrient content, which is kind of what you're getting at. I wouldn't want to be doing, several handfuls of chemical fertilizer in that hole. But, yeah, chunks, you know, the compost is fine. It isn't normally going to be that hot. With chicken manure, you might just put it on the surface of the soil around it. Mm. Steer manure, again, is not so nutrient dense, as it were. Chicken manure is a hotter fertilizer, even so. So, again, better if it is somewhat composted than you throw it on. I mean,
okay,
for me,
Sure. Certainly
I've used fresh horse manure and just dump it on top of my rhubarb this time of year and stand back, and away it goes, you know. So, but, again, horse manure is also not as hot as chicken manure usually. If you're taking it directly for those folks who have a chicken coop or generous neighbors, that you usually want to do some composting first.
Okay, good. And so for fish, as just a general tip and a courtesy to your neighbors and stuff, how deep do we want to bury fish if we're using fish as a soil amendment? What's a safe depth to be sort of protected from enterprising wildlife or, you know, that
that's pretty well put. Yeah. 6 inches to a foot deep, and I suppose that also depends on what, you know, if you've got some fencing around your patch, whether it be electric fencing or gill net or seine webbing strung up four to five, 6 feet high, which, of course, also helps keep the deer out. So that's a good depth to go to. And really, if you have some fish and you have some seaweed also, what I've done also is bury put the fish in the hole first and then put some seaweed on top of it. So I think that the seaweed, to some extent, helps mask some of the flavor, the smells, too. And, of course, you get double duty or more. You get more nutrients from both. I mean, the main thing you get from fish is going to be nitrogen, if there's some bones in it or if they were carcasses or something, maybe it's stuff that your carcass you're going to use for bait and it's been there long, you know, it's been in there too many years, and you bury that. But again, then you throw the seaweed in there and you're going to be getting in phosphorus and all sorts of trace minerals also. So again, you've got a more, I suppose it is a more balanced fertilizer that way.
Nice. That's a good tip.
And the other thing, too, is, you know, with fish, if you're, well, able to cut up the chunks rather than big frozen chunks, cut it up into small pieces, then it will also break down more quickly. So the smaller the chunks of whatever compost or otherwise you have, then they will be broken down faster and then, again, more available to nutrients. The more surface area, the better.
One question that came to mind there, when we're using seaweed to amend soil, do we need to be nervous about the saltiness of the seaweed? Do we need to rinse it well first, or is there a consideration there before putting it into the soil in the garden?
For outdoor use, no. With the amount of rain that we get, are getting as we speak, that's not an issue. Okay. It normally you want to be very careful if you want to use seaweed inside a hoop house or a greenhouse, however, because you can have salt buildup in that situation where you're not getting the continuous leaching of soil. And that's, I think we kind of mentioned a little bit of that even in our soil testing, if folks are doing soil tests, that's something to ask the testing lab to see if you've got salt buildup, which is fertilizer salt buildup. You know, chemical fertilizers have a certain amount of salts that may build up if in drier climates, it's much more of a problem in Arizona and, you know, the intermountain west and that sort of thing versus coastal climates where we get plenty of rain.
Right.
So that would be the one place to rinse if you're going to use it in the greenhouse. And also if you're making, as I do, make the weed juice and seaweed juice for a liquid fertilizer, a liquid boost. That's a place where I do, if I'm mixing the weeds and seaweed, I may rinse off a bucket of seaweed with water once and then divvy that up in among several buckets of my weed juice.
Gotcha.
Because then I'm taking that eventually fermented brown liquid and diluting that maybe 5-1 before I water my plants with it.
That brings an interesting question to mind. When you... Do you have a continuous compost tea going, or do you make a batch of weed juice or compost tea, use it, and then start a new batch? Is it possible to just kind of keep adding more seaweed or more weeds to your liquid fertilizer?
Oh, sure, you could. You know, if you had a bigger, if you had a big plastic barrel or something like that. For me, it tends to be, at this point, I don't have very many weeds yet.
Right.
They're coming. And so that's kind of that will determine when once I have some weeds, then I start making some weed juice. And again, that may be a few weeks from now, which again is good timing for use on planting when you're transplanting, putting in your cabbage or cauliflower, broccoli, lettuce, Swiss chard, tomatoes, any of that sort of thing. That in the greenhouse versus outdoors, that's a good supplement to water them in with, rather than starting them with just straight water, too. So, it's coming.
If you're doing a continual compost tea sort of production, is there a point where it's too rich, or the seaweed or weeds have been in the water for too long, it's too, I don't know, extracted or fermented? How do you know?
Well, I don't know. I suppose when I'm looking at it, what happens, of course, is all the fibers, the organic, fibrous carbon material, from stems of the plants will break down and completely fall apart. So it turns into almost all liquid, although usually there's some, you know, if you're throwing weeds in there, very often you'll have some sand or soil that settles to the bottom.
Gotcha.
And of course, even that, so it gets to the point where, I'll take my drain off the liquid from a bucket, and then, like I said, I'll dilute that.
Right.
And finally, usually rather than keeping adding over and over again, I'll just have kind of multiple buckets going. So, I suppose you could start a new bucket every week, have them in a line, and just use the oldest one first and work along. Like I said, if you've got bigger containers, then that would be something you could have a somewhat I guess you want it to break down for at least a week or two, though. That's maybe the good point to have, that you, so it does. And again, then it becomes, again, more colonized by various beneficial bacteria and other stuff, too.
Okay. Yeah, that is handy-dandy practical. I'm sure there are a lot of people around listening who are using compost tea or considering it. And so it's good to kind of have some practical guidance around putting that into practice. Well, let's see. Before we call it a show, is there anything else we want to leave people? Oh, we've got a question here. Our High Country host, Lars, who's coming up next, has a question here about his garden. Go for it.
Yeah, hi, Ed.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, last year we had so much rain, I ended up covering up one of my cherry trees, and I didn't cover the other one with bisqueen. And the one I covered, I got a good crop of cherries. And the one I didn't cover, I didn't get one cherry that was worth saving. So I figured it was good to cover them. But what I was wondering, my strawberries, I never got any strawberries. I got blossoms after blossoms, but it rained so much, I was wondering if I should cover my strawberries, too, if it's going to rain like it did last year.
Certainly, if you can put some hoops up and hold the plastic up off the strawberries, that will help for a whole bunch of reasons. The key thing, though, you'll want to have the ends open so that bees can get in there, or bees and flies can get in there to pollinate. But the good thing, you know, the warmth will help in the ripening, obviously. And the drier conditions should reduce your slug infestation, too. So that, I would say, beneficial for a bunch of reasons. Give it a shot. And the other thing is, whatever you do, I don't know what you did last year for fertilizing for your strawberries, but you want to be very go lightly. You know, you can't give them too much nitrogen, or you get great big leaves and very few flowers and fruit. So, you know, some seaweed around them, around the plants is great. It's pretty low nutrients, but good stuff that they need. And if you think about where the wild strawberries grow on the beaches, again, it's very low nutrients. So just think about that. In other words, don't give them a whole bunch of fish meal, or you will get big leaves that you might just well dry and make strawberry leaf tea.
Gotcha. So if you're getting a lot of blossoms and no fruit, is pollination a possible issue there? Like,
oh, sure it is, because, you know, with the cold, wet conditions, then the bees and flies are less likely to be out there pollinating. And that goes for apples, cherries, and other assorted fruit, too. So that there's that critical time when they are flowering, so those few days or weeks, whatever it happens to be, that if it isn't warm and sunny, that the bees are going to be active. Doesn't matter how nice the rest of the summer is, you just aren't going to get much fruit.
Is it possible, if that's something we notice, where if it's the blossoms are happening, but it's a kind of grim conditions and we're not noticing any pollinators, is it possible to manually pollinate your strawberry crop? Or like, what do you do?
That would be a very slow process, but yes, you could. I mean, you could certainly do it with something like a small, soft paintbrush, you know, artist paintbrush, to go from plant to plant to plant, or flower to flower to flower. With them, that would be one way to do it, and then same, yeah, it'd be tedious, of course, but doable. And the results are, one of the indications that you have poor pollination is you get these distorted berries, you know, these weirdly shaped berries rather than nice big full size berries. So again, that tells you that they were not well pollinated.
So that might be something that results after a person goes out there and tries to do it themselves and doesn't have quite the precision of a...
Ideally, you'd be doing this on a drier day. The cold, again, the pollen itself is not going to be that viable on the really cold, wet days, too.
Right.
So if it's drier, will help. If it's warmer, that helps. And then, of course, that means that maybe the bees... It certainly isn't going to hurt for you to help out the bees. Let's put it that way.
So, Ed, I got another question. Say I got my cherry and my apple, or my cherry and my strawberries covered, and it's raining like crazy all the time. Would it be advantageous for the pollinators that they would come under my covers and do more work there than around the rest of the places?
Because that could help. And again, you mentioned covering. I'm not sure how exactly you're covering your trees.
I just put up.
But as long as it's open underneath, then again, that may help. And the bugs will probably like those conditions, too. It's probably going to be warmer in there, too. So they may come in from underneath. So just don't, I'm not sure how you're covering them, if you've got some sort of a framework or what it is you're using to
support the plastic. Yeah, I have a framework.
Support the plastic.
Just a flat angled cover on the top so all the sides are open.
Okay.
That sounds good. And
Let's hope for sunshine so we don't have to be doing, let Mother Nature take care of that.
Yeah. Well, and is it, as we're thinking about pollinators and sort of planting gardens and stuff, is it smart to maybe have flowers, like colorful flowers, near fruiting bushes or plants?
Yes, absolutely. So again, and that's something, it's good to, you can do that research online, too, about pollination of course, there the challenge is attracting the pollinators at the right time. Mm. So, like you say, whether you're planting perennials or certain kinds of flowers that will attract the bees, and then at the same time as the cherries, the apples, the strawberries, whatever are blooming that need the pollinators also. And hopefully, again, it's kind of a funny balancing act that which plants are going to be more attractive to the pollinators. So you hope you don't plant something that's going to attract the pollinators away from the stuff that you want pollinated.
Right, right.
I mean, one thing that is a great attractant, certainly, I mean, the bees go crazy for are raspberries. And that, certainly, if you're ever out there watching when your raspberries are being pollinated or when they're flowering, and they don't have big, flashy petals on them, they're quite small, but obviously there's must be a lot of nectar there because, I mean, my raspberry patch is just humming with bees when they are in bloom. And there can be right next to them some these blackberries. They've got nice big white flowers on them. The bees are not, they would rather go to the raspberries first. And usually the blackberries kind of follow them. So that way at least that's a good thing because the bees are in the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, so the raspberries kind of flower a little, they start flowering a week or two before the blackberries. So there's overlap there too.
That's good. So it's not that they go to one and not the other, but they're just there in a greater number, more present, and the blackberries benefit.
Yep, exactly.
Good.
Yeah, so do the research on pollinators, and of course then it's challenging to find, you know, the type of flowers that grow well here in Juneau, or in southeast Alaska, I should say. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's lots of pollinators out there, but you know, they may not like our cool, moist conditions either. So yeah, look at the type of perennials, and again, that's kind of another one of those good places to remind folks on the record keeping to see what is flowering at the same time as your fruit trees and berry bushes and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that is a good thing to consider.
Being out there looking in the garden and seeing what are the bees visiting. You know, you're watching or hearing the bees around you. And see what are the bees' favorites.
Yeah, that's a fun part of it, really. Over time, especially, you get to just kind of really know the relationships at work in your little ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, the blueberries are starting to flower right now. Certainly the bumblebees go for them. Lots of flies do. The hummingbirds, obviously, also. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen one in my yard yet, but again, we just got back. But I've heard from other folks mm-hmm. that the hummingbirds have shown up, and hopefully down by you, too.
Yeah. Yep. They have. Well, maybe that's a good note to end her on, and we'll pick it up again next week. What do you think about that?
Okay, very good. Maybe we can, maybe the weather will be changing enough. Hey, the sun, there's a sucker hole over us here at the moment, but not a very big one.
We'll call it a good
a
omen.
A little, just a hint of sunshine.
A promise of more to come.
Yeah, let's hope so.
All right, thanks so much, Ed.
Yep, you're welcome. Till next week, Orin.
Till next week.
There ain't nothing in the world that I like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes.
That's In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Byarski. We appreciate him getting on the phone with us each week here to share the expertise and field our questions about how do we go about getting some productive gardens here in our gray and soggy corner of the world. Hopefully, you know, maybe we'll have ourselves a nice growing season this year. Could very well be the case. Let's hope so. And we want to say thanks to the Garden Center and the Flower Farm. The Garden Center is opening up on the 24th. That's this coming Tuesday. They're located behind Love and Matter. They'll have fuchsia baskets from Skagit, locally grown pansy bags and bedding plants from the Flower Farm, and bouquet subscriptions available. And you can call the Flower Farm at 772-3464. They're down there at Papke's. Open every day, but Wednesday 10 to 5. And again, the Garden Center opening up on Tuesday. Up next, we've got High Country with the one and only Lars Christensen.
Tomato seed, 'cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery. Out in the garden be much better, and I could be pushing homegrown tomatoes. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What'll life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy.